Hey, everybody. This is Adam Blake. Thanks for coming back to the new PNEU podcast. Today, I have a friend of mine. This is going to be indicative of all these podcasts. They're all friends of mine, people that I respect and appreciate. A guy that maybe 10 years ago-ish, I kind of got turned on to a shop that he ran, which we'll talk about. He's progressed through the industry in various jobs, and now kind of heads up, I would say. Is that
that's okay?
Heads up a component brand that I am very fond of, that I utilize on my bikes and recommend to a lot of customers. I have Mr. Ben Witt, head of Whiskey Components. And Ben, thank you, buddy. It's just phenomenal to see you.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for asking me.
Oh, man. Yeah, what a, you know, I kind of got into this in our first podcast where I was like, you know, these are just so enjoyable to me. Just the opportunity to get to sit with my friends and, like, wax about things, you know, and kind of tell the story of how we got here. Because hopefully, you know, my intention is all these people that I'm going to get to talk about as this podcast progresses have really influenced me somehow or another in my trajectory through the bike industry too, which has lasted almost 20 years at this point.
For sure.
So a little backstory on you. Not sure if it was your first gig, but my first gig of, or my first awareness of your gig in bikes was owner of Milltown Cycles, in Faribault, right?
Correct.
And I got turned on to you via a blog at that time, your blog, and, you know, that was a cool thing to do.
Remember the internet when it was a thing?
Right. Yeah. Not everybody on it. I don't know. Social media probably existed, but I wasn't really on it at that point. Kind of a late adopter. Kind of tell me a little bit about Milltown. You know, I was turned on because even back then, Milltown to me expressed more of this adventure mentality, some gravel riding, kind of, you know, maybe road was a little more prevalent then, and shops were kind of going that way. But Milltown, I never picked up like that. You know, I held akin to what Toby DePaul and Chad Ament did at North Central Cyclery and what we were trying to achieve at World of Bikes at the time.
Sure.
Kind of telling stories with the bike shop, making it a community hub. All these things that now, 10 years later, are like vital for bike shops to succeed. So kind of let me know or, you know, explain how Milltown came about, how long it was about, and what the role in the community was of Milltown.
Yeah, I think I'll start by just saying that, like, I am about people. And I think that's, you know, folks that have known me a short time or a long time, I think that's pretty readily apparent. And that was really the basis of that shop. You know, so I think the activities, you know, the gravel riding or the mountain bike riding that we did were just, you know, kind of outlets for us to get people out and do fun things. You know, like, I liked riding gravel because I don't like riding with cars. You know, like, I rode road bikes at the time, but I've never been a serious road cyclist. Like, it was a way to get outside and ride long distance without that, you know, required double pace line and the etiquette. And, you know, even then, you know, cell phone texting was not really a thing. This is 15 years ago at this point, or certainly wasn't as prevalent of a safety issue as I say it is now. But, you know, who wants to ride with a car 16 inches off your side? And so partly, I think, as you mentioned yourself in North Central, all of those shops were located in, you know, the products of their environment to a certain extent. It's like, you know, any direction from the shop, which was in Faribault, any direction from Northfield, the town I still live in, were these stunning roads that in most cases, no one I knew had ever biked on, or certainly not regularly. And it offered you this opportunity to see the exact same landscape you've seen your entire life 2 miles to the left, you know, and I think that was really important, or that was one of the biggest pitches to try to get a lot of the people to come out with us and experience it. Like, you know, how many times have you driven from Northfield to Cannon Falls, Minnesota on Highway 19? It's like, do you have any idea what's 3 miles off that road, you know?
Right.
And they, like, there was just this whole new world essentially out your back door. And
right.
That was a very appealing thing for me, and it was a really appealing thing for a lot of folks who just, you know, get the bug and get into it.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing when you, are in a role that kind of guides a community somewhat, you know, just with your recommendations and things, and you just make things more accessible to them.
Yep.
You know, like, have you considered
exactly
going here? Have you considered trying this? And when you do, because of the value that you know it can have for you, a lot of people also perceive that value, and then they come back and they're like, holy cow, why didn't you tell me about this like a year ago? That was amazing, you know?
That's exactly it. I think, you know, I've said for a long time now that I consider myself to be a not a salesman, but a professional enabler.
Yeah, right. We you talked know, about like, it last night.
We did. Like, and that's a, I think when you run a business like that, you always sort of, the sale is the assumable part. You know what, you're not selling somebody a bike, you're selling them on the experience.
100%.
And I think that's is still true today, you know, when we're creating products. But it was certainly true then of like, hey, you know, it'd be rad. Why don't you come ride your bike with us and have a good time?
Right.
And like, who doesn't want that, you know, to be a part of something, feel like you're part of something bigger, but really just have fun, you know? And I think that's what we did at the shop. And one of the reasons why that shop was so successful is like, it wasn't about, you know, the seriousness behind it or, you know, like the performance aspect of, you know, a nice bicycle. It's like, well, you know, who doesn't want this experience to be as easy as possible? And that sort of goes towards quality equipment or as comfortable as possible, right? But a lot of it was just like, hey, come out and have this new experience that you may not have known it even existed before.
Yeah, I would say too, back then, 2010, 2009 area, there was a lot of vaguity in bikes. You know, we have more established niches now with tailoring for certain offerings. Sure. But, you know, in 2009, you went to a gravel race, which weren't as prevalent, obviously, but they existed. And it was literally the gamut of bikes.
Oh, yeah.
People were just trying to find ways to utilize that tool to achieve some fun or some experience of some kind of thing, some life-enriching type experience. So it's really interesting what we presented then and what we present now kind of thing.
Yeah. You did ask, brief history of that or, you know, kind of my entry into this world, so to speak. I've always grown up in small business. My family's owned a mid-size small car repair garage for just about 55 years now in Northfield. And I started working there when it was my grandfather's shop. I was 12. And so that, you kind of
relaxed child labor laws.
Totally legit child labor laws. That's when you can begin working at a non-food-based restaurant in the state of Minnesota. So totally on the up and up, paid taxes. And as a middle schooler, getting like a real paycheck.
Yeah,
like,
wild.
Dude, it was awesome. We bought camping gear and Jelly Bellies by the pound. Yep. $8 a pound? Pfft, great. Yeah, I'll take a whole bag.
Still like, it was awesome. Function.
Yeah, absolutely. Shops should run on Jelly Bellies. You know, so grew up in this environment of, you know, customer service and treating people right. And, you know, I think even in the car business more so than the bicycle business, you know, there's this sort of this feeling that, you know, people don't know how they work and everybody's out to get you. And it's like, you know, just like my grandpa told me, like, you run an honest business, you don't have to worry about advertising to a certain extent or things like that. Like, just treat people right, and you know, that's essentially all you need to do. And that's really proved, I think, true my entire career. When turned 16, when you can be a private person working at a business in the state of Minnesota, and I'd always loved bikes, and so that was a big change for me was to kind of leave that family role and start working at the local bike shop when I was 16, and so that was a Yeah, before 16, just, yeah. But did that all through high school, ended up essentially being, you know, manager level at that shop, and then went to college for precisely one semester. I was going to be an art teacher. Didn't work out very well. Turns out art teachers still have to take math classes.
Yeah.
Never my concrete strong
Crazy,
suit.
Crazy, huh?
It was a thing. But came back from school, and Mike Moyer, who had the bike shop at the time, found out that the guy in Faribault was looking to sell the shop. So it took about a week, and he's like, hey, you should do that. And probably one of the best decisions I've ever made.
Yeah, man, I'm very thankful you did it.
Here we are.
Right, we're here. It's turned out pretty well.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more.
That's crazy. Yeah, I started in a shop when I was like just almost 16, yep. Dusting and pumping up tires and vacuuming and stuff, Same. You know, and just kind of that, like, that kind of groundwork, dirty work, you know, shop, kind of thing.
Shop rat in the back.
Yeah, shop rat in the back.
Empty the cardboard.
Yep. From Milltown, and correct me if I'm wrong, but from Milltown, you took a role as a salsa brand ambassador.
Yep.
And that was kind of your entry into the QBP, Quality Bicycle Products family.
That's correct.
Interesting role. My always perception of the ambassador, it wasn't a rep, it wasn't a demo driver, it was like this blending of all kind of things. Yeah. And you really were an ambassador for a brand that was kind of really going at that time. You know, that was maybe, yep, what, 2012?
Yeah, I would have been about then, 2012, yeah. 2013.
Yeah, so Salsa's getting their feet really under them at that point.
Yeah,
how was that, you know?
It was a blast.
It was a lot of travel.
Yeah, I moved into that role. Kind of came to it. My wife and I did a lot of exploring with kind of where we wanted to take the shop at the time. And I just, you know, we looked at buying the coffee shop next door. We looked at opening up a second location. You know, it kind of developed the business in that in Faribault to what it was going to be. And, you know, after about a year, kind of figured out that, like, you know, there's actually nothing wrong with the bike shop. I'm just ready for the next challenge. You know, the business was fine. It was great, you know, but was looking for that next thing. And the role at Salsa, you know, came up. And, during that time, we were a top 10 Salsa dealer. I'd worked with the folks at QBP for, you know, almost 15 years at that point. So Q was a very known quantity to me in terms of, you know, being a great place to work and people I like. And so that it presented a really interesting just a challenge. You know, it was a lot of travel. We traveled about a week a month, which we had our first son at about precisely that time. So that was having a 2 or 3 month old kid and being gone a week a month was certainly a challenge. My wife's amazing. Shout out to her. But it was a really great experience. The role, you're right, was quite unique. It was, you know, a little bit of sales. It was a little bit of demo. It was, you know, so you're selling bikes to shops and teaching shops how to sell salsa. In some ways, sell the idea that we were pushing at our own shop, right?
Right.
How do you get people interested in things they've not done before?
Right.
And I think that's where, you know, Salsa found its early success and continues to, but also with, it was a concept that did need explaining. You know, like, what is a fat bike to someone in California?
Sure. A little, you know, abstract, kind, like, of, in a way. Well, not at least, yeah, right, what they think they're going to see, you know? Yeah.
Or even, you know, the word gravel in California makes no sense.
Right.
But if you call it a fire road, they go, oh, great. You know, like, it was that, you know, terminology change. We're talking about this idea of being in the wilderness on backcountry roads that are low travel. It's like, you know, I remember one of our first trips out to California. It was like, man, we ride gravel because that is our back road.
Right.
That's what we have. Like, I would kill to ride in the fire roads of the Sierra Nevada. So I was like, you need to go do that. You
right.
Know? Like, this is your,
you know, this,
like,
is right there.
They're like, we don't do gravel. It's like, yeah, but you should do, like, don't, you're getting hung up on a term.
Right.
And not understanding the experience.
Embrace the experience,
right,
not whatever word describes,
yeah,
it.
Yeah. And so now, you know, you're seeing these, you know, Grinduro and La Sierra and, like, you know, all of these events that they're, I think each place in the country has kind of taken their own thing with it. But it is this idea of getting outside of populated areas, you know, call it communing with nature or whatever you want, but, like, just getting out, generally some element of physically pushing yourself and seeing what's what. So it was a cool thing to kind of, in some ways, be on the forefront of that trend, mm-hmm, and start to bring that a lot of people, or bring that to a lot of places with Salsa. So it was a cool, really a cool job. I've seen more places out west than I never traveled past Colorado as a shop owner, you know, like, just,
right,
it wasn't a thing. You're running a small business. It was that sort of deal. And, you know, I missed that college road trip experience.
Sure.
You know, like, I didn't go out to Moab for a week over spring break riding bikes.
Right.
And, like, so it was a way in some ways for me to get experience of this wider world as well. So I was learning at the same time as going out and trying to teach people things. And it was a very cool event. I have a very long list of places to go back to.
Oh, I'm sure it just keeps accumulating, you know, in,
yeah,
in that kind of situation, like, oh, this is rad.
Oh,
that,
you
that's
know,
rad.
You spend 6 hours in Bend, Oregon. Like,
right.
Well, I could probably spend a week in Bend. You know, like, you get these little tastes of, like, boy, there's so many awesome places out there. Like, and it was really eye-opening in that regard.
Yeah, little known fact, pulling back the curtain. I had also applied for that Salsa Ambassador job. And I think this may not be exactly, but I think it came down kind of to you and me. And Benton Hunt called me and he's like, hey, man, we're going to go with a different guy. And I was like, well, that's fine. Can you tell me who it is? And he was like, it's Ben Witt. And I was like, oh, yeah, I would have totally done that too. Like, good choice, guys. Bravo. I appreciate that.
I appreciate the compliment. It was a thing.
Yeah, and we had actually, if I remember it right, we're even communicating during it. You know,
we may have.
It was quite interesting. But, you know, that's kind of that level of, at that time, I don't know if this is the right term, but like the inner circle kind of thing. You know, if you were into that, there just wasn't quite as many people really doing ultra endurance gravel or mountain and what has become and established as adventure by bike, to steal Salsa's term. It just wasn't the biggest thing. So you knew everybody, you know.
The world was smaller.
Right. We talked and, you know, you kind of communicated with everyone.
Well, we were joking about that last night, you know, like the heyday of the MTBR forum and the Dirt Rag forum and, you know, these, you know, like I said, when the internet was small, right, like you had these core places that attracted, you know, the 200 of us that thought something was neat, you know, and it really was like almost that small, you know, to your point where, like, you know, I still know some of those folks that, you know, I didn't meet him in person for 8 years, you know.
Right.
It was just this vehicle that allowed you to get together and share these common interests.
Yeah. So that's and now you're in Whiskey Components.
Yeah.
Official title at Whiskey.
I am the brand business manager.
Parts Co. Man, that is official.
It's a big thing.
Responsibilities and stuff.
Oh, you should see my business card. Oh, man. It's amazing. Mine's lime green, just to make it a little bit different.
I like it.
Yeah, you got to stand out.
And you know, we'll kind of touch on whiskey here a little bit more, but I think when we're still establishing this relationship and the history, we knew each other, but our meeting, our really official meeting that I'm aware of, pretty good story. Triple D, Winter Race in Dubuque, Iowa.
All kinds of crazies.
All kinds of crazies at that point. Maybe, again, 2009, 2010, something in there, you know.
Mr. Andres.
Yeah. 70 miles, roughly, of like sheer brutality.
I never finished it.
Holy mackerel.
I think I started three times and never finished. My willingness to suffer is just not that great.
Even on the good years, that race is brutal. Yeah. It just like, you know, we didn't know things, right? Blissfully ignorant.
No way.
We're going to tromp through a cornfield for 20 miles. And, you know, like, wow, okay.
The experimentation was, like, every tier point, like,
fat really, front, skinny rear, skinnies trying to do this, fat.
Tandem once. Tandem. The year that wasn't supposed to snow, and then it snowed 16 inches, like, the night before. That was neat. That was a. That did not work well.
Yeah, right.
But it was fun.
It was, and it's a phenomenal race. My first exposure, you know, with some of the Northern Minnesota and things like that, ITI, those all existed. But more of in like a grassroots local fat bike, that was all we had in Iowa, really.
The distance appealed to me, too. I always thought
70
like, you know,
seemed really viable.
Oh, that's
viable.
Totally doable compared to 140.
Right.
And I think, that it just resonated with me. It was a cool community and fun chance to get the southern Minnesota, northern, western Iowa folks together. Like, it was just a great scene.
Yeah, it was. People came from a lot of places, because if you had a fat bike at that point, specifically, you were searching for places to use this bike and push that bike. At least if you were like me and the people I knew, we were trying to find, like, not validate, because that had already been done, but like, utilize, like, okay, there's 8 inches of snow. Can I ride this at 2 PSI? You know, is this possible? Because I've never been able to experience this before, and all things just lined up for this new experience for me, you know.
And I'll say too, I think it's you know, more than like validating the equipment for me, like I'm just an incredibly social person.
Yeah, sure.
like I sold my first Pugsley because I did it wrong. You know, it was geared as a single speed, way too high. Again, you know, you don't know what you don't know.
Right.
I had no, you know, way too high to be rideable in proper winter conditions. And there wasn't anybody to ride it with because at the time, like, you know, you're riding alone.
Yeah.
And so alone in the winter, in the dark, like, that's some people's jam. It didn't work for me. So I think, you know, the Triple D kind of came about as this, like, meeting of the minds of the crazies, so to speak, of just that. Like, hey, let's get together. Let's have some food. Let's try to do this thing and laugh about how much we fell over in the cornfield. You know?
Right,
like,
right, right.
It's not so much a, you know, the top three people race. Everybody else tries to finish. And I think that's as common core, I think, to a lot of these events, certainly as they started, where it's like, man, I'm never going to be the front of anything. Right. Well, I'm going to try.
Yeah, for sure. That I think the Triple D, you know, there was a mentality shift too, not to go into a long diatribe about it, but back then you reflected fondly upon suffering.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah,
you were presented some garbage stuff. And when you survived, you got back, and there was laughter and fondness, and you were hurting units, you know, because, I mean, fastest I've ever done that 70 miles is maybe 5.5 hours.
Yeah,
slowest is more like 12.
Yeah, 6 days later, I showed up at the finish.
And I've done ones where it's like, by my math, we'll be done tomorrow about 3 p.m., yeah, you know? I'm not prepared for that. But Triple D aside, so after the race, social, having fun, we are at a place in Dubuque. I believe it was the Busted Lift.
I think that is correct.
They have it's a cool little downstairs bar, and, you know, everyone's having a good time. We're playing a little ring string toss game.
It was an excellent experience.
It was a great experience. Great core group there, too, yeah, you know. It was good. And through the door, if I remember it right, through the door, an angelic light comes blasting through, and my friend James Zimmerman, comes in with bags of cheeseburgers.
Full out bags. I think they were.
Full on bags.
Dozens of cheeseburgers.
Yeah, like.
No exaggeration. It was
paper,
amazing.
Grocery sack size bags of cheeseburgers. And they were just dumped onto this table.
And I don't remember how he explained that he had, like, come across this restaurant and ordered, like, literally 60 cheeseburgers. But it was, like, the best thing I'd ever seen in my life.
And if you know, I just was like, oh, yeah, well, Z found 60 cheeseburgers for us at 11 at night or whatever it was, you know?
It was not early.
And so we sit down, and, you know, food brings everyone together. So yeah. I think that experience, you know, breaking bread with your brother kind of thing.
Absolutely.
It really established a connection that, you know, I know that I've always felt with you. We still talk from time to time about all sorts of breadth of things in the bike world.
For sure.
But... you know, now you're in your current role, Whiskey Components. What is, if somebody is not familiar, what is Whiskey Components without saying, like, you know, these specific components? Sure. What is the role that Whiskey plays for cyclists?
Sure. I'd say we're a company that makes high-end carbon fiber and nice aluminum parts to help make your ride easier or more comfortable. You know, so... there's a fitment aspect to what we do in terms of cockpit we offer. There is, you know, an ease of riding, certainly with, you know, carbon fiber wheels, or there's comfort associated with carbon handlebars or a carbon fork. We're focused at Whiskey on, you know, looking in two directions when we design products, which is different than, like, a lot of other companies in our sphere, where we look to make those innovative products that, you know, somebody else may not be making. And that comes in two things because of our shop experience. Because I have, you know, 15 years in shops, owned a shop for 10. Our product manager owned a shop for 15. So we're very minded in terms of what do you need at a bike shop. You know, and you need those things that are new and exciting to bring people in. You know, that get people trying something different, right? But as a shop, you also need those service parts that, hey, I got a 13-year-old light speed road bike, and, you know, probably shouldn't ride that Alpha Q fork anymore.
Or ever.
Right. So one of the last forks that we introduced was a short reach caliper road fork to fit really a 15-year-old bike. And so we get to kind of do both. You know, we get to make these products that are fun and forward looking, but also products that are like, you know, we make a straight steer tube cross fork that's a 12 mm flat mount. Looks great on steel bikes. You can run them on lug bikes. Fits every cross check ever made. You know, so it's a different mentality than just this, like, what's aero? What's the lightest? What's the cutting edge? And then, you know, constantly trying to chase that bleeding edge of product. We also get to look backward and say, well, what isn't somebody making that, you know, because we're part of QBP and because we're part of this greater organization, what can we offer to shops that is unique and different to solve either those issues or to solve those fitment things that, haven't been done before arguably should be done.
Yeah, I agree. I think one of my biggest allures to me as a service rider, spec some custom bikes, do a lot of repairs, that kind of stuff in the shop, is regularly Whiskey provides me a component that I assumed I just couldn't do for the customer. Yep. You know, like a fork, an old steel fork bends or breaks or this or that. And I'm like, oh man, I don't know, you know, if mm-hmm. I'm going to be able to get you anything but a pretty rudimentary dimension fork or something. And lo and behold, Whiskey like makes a carbon version that I can not only improve that customer's ride because they probably have some sentimental value with that bike. That's why Absolutely. They're looking to repair it. You know, unfortunately, I don't know what the word is there, but like some newer brands, because I would consider Whiskey still a pretty newer brand.
Yeah.
Some newer brands, just with limitations and focus and stuff, you know, they're only going forward from start date forward. You know, there's no backwards compatibility for things. Mm-hmm. You know, nobody that's like coming out with. You know, whatever it is making it so you can do it on your 7-speed drivetrain. You know what right. I mean? Like
yep.
ceramic pulleys do not exist for an Allevio derailleur. For well, sure. They probably do, but you know what I mean?
I do know what you mean. Yeah, it's fun.
It's interesting with Whiskey. I find that actually quite regularly, you know, so I can rely on Whiskey as a purveyor of the components on brand new full carbon tie gravel bike with all the newest Radis features. And yeah. I can rely on it for a 15-year-old light-speed road bike, you know? Yep. It's really interesting to me because you just don't see that in a lot of brands until maybe they get so big. Then they kind of double back a little mm-hmm. bit. But until then, as they're growing, it's usually like plow straight forward, you know? Yep. And I like that Whiskey reflects as well as progresses. It's an mm-hmm. interesting dynamic.
Yeah, it's been... You know, with the departure of Alpha Q, with some of those manufacturers going away, they're fun projects to do in some ways because, I mean, you've seen my basement recently. I have a lot of bikes in it. And like,
couple.
Just a few. Sorry, Meg. And, you know, there's.
Also, sorry, Meg.
Yeah, also, sorry, Meg. It's Adam's fault. you know, but it's cool to be able to support people in those roles because I know there are folks like you looking for products. But I think there's also a pretty strong business case to be made that, like, you know, that newfangled widget that's out there, there might be, you know, call it 1,000 bikes that will fit right. something that we do in the entire world. We're not going to sell a ton of those, but it's really fun to chase that leading edge and chase those new and exciting things and make things somebody else doesn't. It's also exciting for me to say, well, there's 10,000 road bikes out there that may need this particular fork, and all the ones that are available are heavy and really ugly and 10 years old. Right. You're like, I bet we can do something different. So to bring that same design aesthetic and that same, you know, refined nature to a product that's made for something older, suddenly you have a really, to your point, you have a really unique thing that, you know, it's a great business case because there's a ton of things to sell it to and almost no competition because the world has moved on in a certain extent, but there's still a need for those products to keep those good bikes moving. So it just fits a whole bunch of different hats. Yeah. Or like, this is it's a cool thing to do.
Yeah, I think that for me, what I like is also, you know, maybe that guy or gal that's riding the 15-year-old road bike maybe hasn't been exposed for their own personal reasons maybe or just because they're comfortable with their current equipment mm-hmm. to new modern things. And what I like the opportunity to do, not that there's any devaluing of classic, you know, materials and stuff like that. But
certainly.
When I can implement a more modern, doing the finger quotes part, like a carbon fiber fork, you know,
yep.
That kind of raises their awareness. And then as they continue to succeed with it, it kind of validates to them somebody who maybe would have ho-hummed carbon across the board yep. is now aware that like, whoa, you know, this carbon part has been reliable and durable. Sure. And has improved my cycling experience, maybe I want to look at something new at this point, you know? And because we are still moving forward and we're always tailoring bikes and things like that. So, you know, and from a bike retailer spot, obviously I want to sell new bikes to mm-hmm. a certain extent. So kind of opening that door, I think, is the real key for me in a bike shop of utilizing Whiskey.
Sure.
You know, and I appreciate, you know, I appreciate that because necessity at that point, usually something has failed and it needs to be replaced. Yep. That's why it's getting replaced. I'm not looking for a quote unquote upgrade. So if I can implement that at a reasonable price, too, in most cases, I can get my foot in the door. I can make a really ride-improving recommendation to that customer and establish relationships and reliability and stuff.
Yeah, that's what we're about. And I think, you know, a big tenet for us at Whiskey, too, because we come from shops and that is large, almost all of our stuff is still sold through traditional retailers. It's like, you know, we have to not only provide those products to you at something you feel comfortable recommending, but also at a price that allows you to make money as well. And I think so that's a core product issue for us as well. You know, sustainability of bike shops and profitability is a big core of what we do.
Yeah. And I definitely appreciate it. So we are on fatbike.com. This podcast is on fatbike.com. We see more and more carbon everything in fat bikes nowadays, whiskey being one of my go-to brands for a lot of different things. But I think we should maybe like dispel some considerations of carbon or notions of carbon and maybe verify some other reasons why specifically let's just stick with carbon in fat bikes. Couple things, you know, like carbon is always lighter. Not, I mean, you know, it may be lighter grammed or, you know,
perhaps.
Like, right, perhaps, right? Yeah. It's not a guarantee. Carbon is fragile. Just, you know, to me is like not so correct anymore. It has things that it doesn't like to have happen to it.
Sharp impacts.
Abrupt, sharp impacts. Not so good on carbon. But I'm kind of the mindset now, just in an overview of carbon, that if I was going to fail with the quality of carbon that most companies who are testing and purveying are actually putting out, I'm pretty confident I'd fail just about any material. You know, if that impact happens that breaks a carbon bar, it may not have broken in the same way, but an aluminum bar would have bent to the point where I couldn't utilize it, even steel. You know, so the failure may not be identical, but the failure would still be there.
Yeah, I would say that what trips people up a lot is how carbon fails.
Right.
You know, like to your point, if you hit a rock hard enough with an aluminum rim, that's going to dent your sidewall. It's like that would have broken a carbon rim.
Right.
That aluminum rim is still failed.
And right.
I think there's a lot of people that are like, well, I can pull it out with the pliers. Like, hey, you shouldn't do that. You know, like that's one of the things that's kind of, I think, given carbon wheels a bad name. To your point, yes, they are more expensive. They'll fail in a situation that really any other product probably would have technically failed in.
Right.
But a lot of people, I think, ride in particular an aluminum rim, you know, their willingness to accept a dent that really has, you know, compromised that product, like, that's fine. Like, well, carbon just doesn't allow you that option.
Right. It kind of forces your hand a little more. And visually, the failures are different. You know, you see splintering and stuff in carbon versus a bend or a hairline crack.
Yeah,
but, you know, to me, a crack is a crack.
Exactly.
You know, as far as reliability goes.
Yeah. Yeah, I tell people a lot. It's like, you know, people assume that carbon is light. And one of the main pitches for me for carbon is like carbon allows you to design structures you can't oftentimes do in a similar or dissimilar material, right? You can shape a carbon down tube in a way that you cannot shape a steel down tube.
Agreed.
Right? You know, carbon fat bike now with a down tube that's 80 millimeters wide that flares out to a 100 millimeter wide bottom bracket allows you to tune those structures in a way that you just simply can't do. We can make handlebars in carbon that you could make something that gets your hands to the same position in a different material, but how you get there or how they fit or how you can flare them and change things, you can't extrude an aluminum bar in that way. You know, so you can literally do things because of the material that you can't in others. And so they do happen to be light. But what they really are is you're able to build these structures that may be the same weight as an aluminum product, but maybe in a handlebar case, they flex more in a way that you want them to, and you're able to dial in that comfort. In the case of a wheel, you might have a carbon rim that's the same weight as an aluminum rim, but me at 215 pounds, I can't ride that aluminum rim because it flexes so much that it is a very negative detractor to performance, where that carbon rim at the same weight is so stiffer, and a lot of times you can drop down a level and go to an even lighter spoke. So you're further cutting weight on your wheel assembly, But having this structure that responds, it's lightweight, that say it feels light. You know, when you go to turn a bike, you don't have that rim bending. The bike just turns. And so even at, you know, like say you hear that, you know, argument all the time, I can build a wheel set in aluminum the same weight as a carbon for a third of the price. Like, yes, you can, but it's not going to perform the same.
Right.
You know, the material physically functions differently.
Yeah.
And yes, there's a cost to that, but there's a cost to everything.
Sure. Right. Whatever. I mean, there's a cost to everything. It's more of a value than an overall cost. You know, how much do you value this? And wheels for me being, you know, and by the way, a good looking 215 pounds.
Oh, thank you. That's mighty kind.
Oh man. But being, you know,
face for radio.
That's why we do podcasts, not video podcasts. I'm
totally into that.
but the wheel is always the one that I talk about because, you know, I'm about 220, 225 pounds as well. I ride bikes in a way that I really demand a lot out of my wheels. And sure, I can like dig the basement out with an aluminum wheel set, but I can't corner on it because the wheel flex is out of the way, you know? It's a ride quality thing. It's a reliability certain to me, and especially wheels of like tracking and handling kind of that rougher, you know, go ride a rock garden on a 350 gram aluminum rim with Revolution spokes and then go ride it on a 350 gram carbon rim with a Revolution spoke. One is definitively easier than the other one.
Yeah. I would say too that, you know, like I said, talking about fat bikes, it's, you know, handlebars and seat posts. We're riding frozen, choppy, really, in a lot of cases, terrible conditions on largely rigid bicycles. You know, so carbon handlebars, like, you know, if you don't have a carbon handlebar on your fat bike, man, try one. You'll never go back. Right. Like, yeah, they're so much warmer, first off. Like,
yeah. That's something thermolysis? Is that the correct term? Is that what it is? The transfer of heat, thermolysis?
I'm going to trust you on that.
I may be making that up.
Sounds like you know what you're talking
afterwards.
About. That's fine. But just, you know, they don't get cold. You don't have this heat sink that you're holding on to. Like, man, that was the biggest revelation for me going to a carbon bar in the winter, like, man, just for sheer comfort, keeping your hands warmer, you know, pogies are not, gloves are not, hand, like, however else you dress up your setup, a carbon handlebar is just unquestionably warmer, and it shocks a lot of people.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I notice it. I recently installed some whiskey bars on my salsa bear grease.
Did you know?
Oh, man.
Well, I appreciate
good
that.
Good friend got a hold of some for me. And in the same temperature, and this is not accounting for all variables, but in scientific, basically the same temperature rating, 20 degrees, I wear a lighter glove on my carbon bars, which to me, equal comfort as far as like cold and stuff, better comfort as far as vibration and in the hands.
Yep.
Also for me, which I think is always the premium, better control of my bike because I have a better connection to my grips, my shifters, my dropper, which I begrudgingly use, but love it on my fat bike.
We are old.
I know. Oh, man. I mean, a dropper.
Grumpy. Super grumpy.
Put your belly button on the seat. Get back.
That's,
you know,
not
whatever.
The same thing.
I know. Dropper. Hey, man, dropper all day, every day now. I'm such a convert. I can't even start. It ruins my aura or whatever. but... You know, so like it's the peripheral benefits too, right? You
absolutely.
Know, like if I feel more in control in a groomed single track or a fat bike stomping situation, you know, and I can get the same expectations of reliability, durability to a degree, you know, that's what I'm looking for. And like you mentioned, obviously certain things cost, right? But my value personally for that kind of thing in cycling is tremendous, you know?
Yeah.
So if it's a reasonable price, I'm willing to pay that to incur all those benefits.
Yeah.
Plus they look really good on my bike.
Yeah. And that, you know, that's that conversation. We have a lot of people that, you know, they'll come to us for wheels, but they'll come asking about wheels, I should say, first. And, you know, the question that I pose back to them, like, are your current wheels tubeless? You know, and if the answer is no, tubeless on a fat bike, great. Do that.
Done.
First.
Yeah, first thing.
And then do you have a carbon bar? You know, right. I would say the carbon seat post is second. Like that same thing, like having a post that flexes, that's comfortable, that, you know, it happens to be lightweight, but you buy it so you don't send all that shock up your back.
Right.
You know, the relatively small upgrades that make a disproportionately big effect on what you're doing. It's like, do all those things and then let's talk about carbon wheels. You know, like all of those things are good, but one, the cost benefit for changing out to a carbon cockpit first on really any bike is so much less than looking at wheels, and most people will see a bigger benefit there to start with.
Yeah, I totally agree. Just return on investment kind of thing, right?
Absolutely. Like, exactly. Well, we all make those choices, right? So, like, start there. It's like get a tubeless kit. Most aluminum rims now can be run tubeless properly. Big fan of doing things properly as designed and instructed by manufacturers. So,
boy, we did things not properly for a lot of years.
I will not admit to any of that.
I gorilla taped a ton of rolling derrels. I'll say it. I don't care. It was awesome. Non-tubeless tires, non-tubeless rims.
This is me not talking.
I know. Isn't that ridiculous? Holy cow. I didn't purvey it to customers, but I would do it on, you know, my bike. I'll try anything. Yeah,
I love where we are today.
Yeah, me too. It's much so more much enjoyable, better. Right?
Oh, goodness.
And reliable, right? I always focus back on reliable. Like, yes, could we execute it back then?
Maybe.
Yeah, right. Functionally, it could be executed. At 2 PSI, was it reliable? You know, at every day, could you get on the bike and expect it to function exactly right? No. Near what we can do now with components. It's just total alteration, mm-hmm. I love that you talk about bar seat post first kind of thing, because admittedly, I'm a little heavier, but carbon wheels to me are game changers.
I couldn't agree more.
Great to increase comfort and points of contact. And, you know, people think that, like, fat bike is smooth because I usually test ride it on, like, sidewalks and stuff.
Yeah.
But what fat bike lets me do is get even into the burlier stuff, you know? Yeah. So, like, where it's smooth on the smooth stuff, I don't intend to ride the smooth stuff. I'm riding some nasty stuff, bigger the rocks, more sand, more logs.
It's the cornfield.
That's what I'm looking for, right? Riding through a cornfield, you know?
They've always been that bike, I think, that allows you to just ride. You
know, like everywhere.
Everywhere. They maybe aren't the perfect bike in almost any condition.
Right.
Until, you know, they are.
Occasionally.
But I think you understand what I mean by that. But, like, if you're looking for a bike to go out your front door and ride anything you come across, pretty darn good choice.
Yeah, we put on a Friday night fat bike ride from World of Bikes. We have for almost 10 years now. And regularly the question I ask to new people is, you ever ridden here before?
Mm.
No. Yeah. You ever even thought about riding here before? No.
Yeah.
You should ride here more. Oh, yeah. You know, and their eyes are just saucers at that point because they are so far off the beaten path that their previous hybrid or road bike or even mountain bike allowed them to ride. It just blows minds all the time, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's what I like, you know, is exposure and, like, challenge. You know, I kind of like to be challenged. I kind of like to challenge people, push them into something that is not unsafe, but is maybe daunting to just look at. It's like, well, I could never do that. But one of the things I like about fat bike group rides or events like Triple D, when we were learning more and we're still learning, was you didn't think it was possible. And then lo and behold, here comes Dennis Grohl rolling right past you on endomorphs on a Pugsley. And you're standing there wondering, and he's just cruising, you know, and it's like, man. It can be done.
It is possible.
Holy cow. Now I have to reframe everything because I just conceded that it couldn't be done. But now that I know it can, I can't hide that. I can't turn away from that. Yep. And the drive in me says I have to figure out how to make this approachable and do it. Let's take one quick second. We'll just take a break. And we'll touch back. I want to touch on a couple of things that you're now going to be involved in. Mm-hmm. And though this is fatbike.com, a lot of my background is in gravel, so we'll kind of divert towards gravel and kind of talk about those things. We'll be back real quick. All right, we are back. My buddy Ben Witt, product manager, Whiskey Components. I'm up in Bloomington, Minneapolis area.
Scenic West Bloomington.
Scenic West Bloomington. We've been talking about more whiskeys, components in fat biking, but whiskey has a breadth of components. One of the newer things, the offering that they have hit right as this is kind of coming to prevalence, I think, is the flared drop bar in both aluminum and carbon offerings in multiple sizes, multiple flares, mm-hmm. that's kind of a big thing, and specifically in gravel, which, you know, we kind of touched on a couple times. Gravel, to me, you know, I grew up in rural Iowa. We rode bikes on gravel because that's what we had. It was out the back door, to use a term that you used earlier. But now gravel, you know, I said on the last podcast, and I don't have to be the one to say this, definitively a thing. People are looking to progress in gravel. Gravel races are getting bigger and more prevalent and better in many, many cases. Touch on whiskey, you know, focusing on, you know, staying ahead of the game, or at least on the front, because we've talked about how they reflect back, but, you know, new things like flare bars, maybe new other options for people in cases. You know, how do you make that decision to be like, you know, gravel is so viable at this point, and obviously you've got your finger on it to a degree, being in the Q world and stuff, but you make a distinction that, like, you know, we're going to not only offer a flared gravel bar, I'll just call it a gravel bar, but we're going to do it in multiple flares, 7, 12, 24, is that correct?
Yep.
Multiple widths, and aluminum and carbon. Like, that's a pretty big investment to just create all of those things. How do you get there? You know, is there like a light bulb that goes off where you're like, yeah, we have to get on board with this train?
I think just in general, like, there are so many different kinds of drop bar bicycles at this point, and people's preferences within those bicycles is huge. So, you know, coming from the shop, like, where you service all different kinds of riders, like, you know, I wouldn't say that any of those products are really limited to gravel or even really necessarily inspired by gravel, but they're inspired by comfort and individual fit and preference, right? So, you know, certainly the wider flare bars, I think, lend themselves and have been pitched and marketed as gravel products, because that's, you know, that's the heyday of what is new and what is now,
right?
But what we're talking about of those are, you know, this idea of comfort and control, right? If your bike fits you, if you can access all of those hand positions, if you have a, you know, a wide enough platform to, you know, feel confident when that road surface turns to 4 inches of class five in, you know, a half a mile, that's what those wider flares are really about. And it's all about, you know, offering the right product to fit a rider. So for us, that's, you know, having narrow handlebars, right? 38 is one of the more common sizes of handlebar we sell,
right,
in varying widths. You know, so not just saying, well, flared bars have to be really wide. Like, you know, you need to fit that breadth of the population, because all kinds of people are coming to gravel. And that's a price point thing as much as an aesthetic thing, as much as it's a, you know, material choice. So in my mind, you know, it's one of the bigger categories we play in, and to your point, it is an investment. But it's also hitting at one of the largest sections of the industry, and one of those core tenants that we build to going to the shop side of things is, you know, building on a fit station. You know, having a 6-degree flare bar, which is really a bar we made for traditional road bikes. You know, it's enough flare so you don't hit your elbows when you're in the drops. You know, a shorter reach because STI levers are getting really long. So it's, you know, just in some ways a very normal product. And then you have a, you know, a fitment range that comes along with that. So I think it's easy to pigeonhole some of those products. We would certainly sell a wide flared bar to someone that rides a traditional road bike if that is what, you know, what they're looking for fit and comfort.
Sure. Yeah. I guess, you know, I shouldn't pigeonhole. I tend to refer to them as gravel bars or gravel oriented bars because of the prevalency. But, you know, as I just look out the window, I'd run some flared bars on like an All City Zigzag and probably shred on that.
Absolutely.
Bike. You know, yeah. So I could see, you know, just to verify, you know, I agree that can be implemented in more and probably will continue to trickle into more things, but probably established in gravel.
Yeah, there's certainly
the viability there. Maybe, you know, established in gravel.
Yeah, and I mean, it's a viable market segment for us to look at developing products for.
Right.
You know, like, that's not to say that it isn't, but I think to your point, we're seeing those things come back as just like, hey, this fits a person better,
right,
across a whole spectrum.
Right.
Like, you know, it's why you're seeing, generally speaking, wide bars with more flare in a mountain bike standpoint. You know, like, How do you fit somebody, give them more control, make them more comfortable, to your earlier point, make them more confident on the bike so that they're able to try things that are outside of their comfort zone. And a lot of just like, for years, we set up people on road bikes without touching the drops.
Right.
You know, I think that was one of the biggest changes when you had somebody come into the shop. It's like bikes forever, you know, kind of, and you'll know what I mean when I say it, in the Lance era, you know, were road bikes and your main position was the hood and the flat. And like, it was almost an assumption, like almost no one is flexible enough to use the drops.
Right.
So they were almost this, you know, almost an afterthought unless you were, you know, a fit road racer.
Right.
And I think what you're seeing now is as a broader audience comes to, you know, thinner tire, really, you know, even a 42 is thin compared to a mountain bike. You know, these thinner tire drop bar bikes that, you know, they have front ends that are tall enough that allow a normal person to easily access all of those different hand positions. You know, that's now the norm. And that's, I think, what's largely driving this drop shape development. How do we maximize it now that in a lot of cases, you know, I have bikes that the drop is my main position.
For sure.
You know, that is actually at the compromise of all of the other ones. And so I think you're seeing more people come to that point as not only riding has changed, but as the industry has changed how we build bicycles.
Right.
And who we build
long
bicycles
and low,
for.
Not really applicable to too many people anymore.
It never
super
was.
Super saddle to bar drop, yeah, that
it,
kind of thing.
It just, never was. And so, you know, I would argue that as, you know, you get this kind of drive towards inclusivity and this drive towards building bicycles for real people, because that's really who we're trying to target and get out to do more stuff, that's where you're seeing this stuff develop. And again, to your point, gravel is sort of that pointy tip of the spear at this point.
Boy, you are like the best lead-in guy ever, because let's talk inclusivity.
Sure.
Let's talk gravel. This is the first official of this year, this race.
It is.
But it's a continuation of a mindset of another race. Can clarify that a little bit?
Sure.
Almanzo 100. Mm-hmm. A lot of people recognize as maybe the biggest first group grassroots race, no entry fees, no really anything, you know, but a route.
It's a seminal event, I think, in the Midwest development of gravel.
Definitely established, and you know, the numbers that people have seen at Almanzo are just tremendous. You know, easily 1,000 riders in an Almanzo.
Yeah.
You are kind of taking the reins of that ideals and presenting your own race, moving slightly to Northfield now, your home base.
Yeah, so I'll clarify that a little bit because, you know, words,
yeah, dude,
words are important.
I'm not sure exactly this goes.
So Marty Larson and I worked with Chris Gogan to bring the Almanzo event to Northfield last year. So Northfield's my hometown. It's where I currently live. You know, the people at Q jokingly refer to me as the mayor of Northfield in my zealotry to try to get cool people to move to my town.
Good role for you.
Yeah, I want a sash, you know, just frilly sash,
I think. Get one.
I might anyway. You know, I'm really about trying to make my community as good as it can be. And, you know, bringing people, you know, to this whole point of inclusivity. Like, I want cool people to live where I live to build this community and kind of, you know, make life better, right?
Right.
And so we worked with Chris. Chris had expressed a desire to bring the event, you know, to Northfield, to a different place. And so we worked with him last year. Our local community built the routes. You know, it's our backyard. Mm. I like that phrase. And so we put together the routes. You know, he brought people to town and made the announcement that that was going to be the last Almanzo. You know, he wanted to be done with the event. And, you know, Almanzo really is Chris.
Yeah, most definitely.
It just is.
They are akin.
Yep. And so we are certainly wanting to carry on some of the ideals, you know, that Almanzo was built on, because in a lot of ways that is the culture that Marty and I grew up in. You know, we grew up in the Frothy Mug single speed series in Minneapolis and grew up in this idea of putting on, you know, I used to run gravel rides at our shop. We called it a fall gravel tour. You know, we'd do 40 to 50 mile route, you know, kind of like Triple D. You know, you did a thing, but you didn't have to spend 5 days doing it. You didn't feel like you were totally shredded at the end. With this just mindset of, you know, show up and ride a bike. And I think that at its core was what Almanzo tried to get to do. It tried to push people to do something else. It was my first gravel century. I'm sure that's true of a lot of people.
Oh, yeah.
And just, you know, it's amazing to see what Chris had brought to that community in terms of exactly that, getting people to come ride bikes, push themselves and do something they hadn't done. And so we're certainly carrying forward a lot of those you know, just ideals. Like it's a, it hits right at my and Marty's nature in terms of what we want to bring. So we're hosting an event in Northfield. It's going to be run on the same routes that we did last year, by and large. It's called the Haywood. The Haywood is named for the hero of the Jesse James bank raid in Northfield. So if you're not familiar, after the Civil War, Jesse James and his gang of raiders came north, essentially along the Mississippi River, and they robbed banks in towns, progressively moving north out of Missouri. Northfield was the northernmost point that they got. So they tried to rob the bank in Northfield, and Joseph Lee Haywood was treasurer at Carlton and actually was a bank teller as well. And he lied to the robbers and told them that he did not know the combination for the safe, when in fact the safe was unlocked. So they literally never tried the door.
It's a good deterrent.
It was a great deterrent, but and they shot him. He died. Oh, so he was one rough. Of the only town casualties for the town, and really saved the town. You know, right. That time was before FDIC, no federally insured deposits.
Yeah, right. That money's gone.
You know, the bank robbers got away with $26.70, which was what in the till, instead of the $12,000+ that were in the bank vault.
Right.
And so the town has a big celebration every year called the Defeat of Jesse James Days, and there's, you know, carnivals and reenactments of all this and stuff. And, you know, we wanted to name it after him in honor of that sacrifice, but also to, you know, root the name of the event to the place. You know, you are coming into our town, and we do feel very strongly that we're not only bringing people to do an event, but also bringing people into town to showcase what Northfield has to offer and what the surrounding area can provide to folks, because it is truly some of the most stunning riding, you know, I've ever done, and it's right outside of town. So that's sort of the progression of things. The website is live. Registration is coming. And we're running it in a very similar way to a lot of what those, you know, you use the word grassroots, and I think that's it, right? We don't have corporate sponsorship. There is no entry fee. You know, we want people to come and ride bikes. You know, I had a guy ask the other day, can I bring aero bars? Like, sure, man. You know, like,
yeah, run what you brought.
Fair question. Yeah, fair question. It's like, dude,
don't
show up.
Yeah, do it.
Yeah, whatever you want to ride, and, you know, kind of, you know, do what you will. So it's a neat thing. We're really excited about that. You know, and we'll make some changes to how events have been run in the past. We are accepting donations for the ride. That's something we're, you know, trying to be public about as well. It's like, this is Marty and I doing this. This isn't a profit-making business. Right. So there is no, you know, there's no event gallery. So there's no corporate sponsorship. We got to pay for insurance and porta potties.
Right.
You know, and so.
And that's what you should expect, right? Not a lot of frills here and there.
That's exactly
it.
Like,
it's just go ride gravel.
It's
enjoy.
About the ride. And it's about, you know, like, I want people to meet like you and I met at Triple D. Like, I want people to form that community and have these shared experiences. And that's what Marty and I really want to bring, you know, to the community, and, you know, offer that, you know, just kind of carry forth that tradition of, like, I've met so many people doing events in that way, in those experiences, you know, walking up Oriole Hill, a lady passed me on a cross check in Teva sandals. Right. I'll never forget that. Like, that was one of the coolest things I've ever seen. And I clapped for her because it was awesome. You know, like, I want people to have those kinds of experiences. And so that's what Marty and I want to bring. And I couldn't be more excited about it.
Yeah, man. Distances?
50, 110, 170, and 380.
Booyah! 380.
That's a big one.
That's a big dog.
That's a big one.
Yeah. Cutoff times?
You know, we'll be at the finish late. I don't know.
Yeah, for
late,
a while.
Late enough. Yeah. I had a buddy said it would, he was like, it's like, you're going to be at the finish when I finish the 380? He's like, well, my house is four blocks away. So you're probably like, if you're that late, you just call me, just come on over. He's like, oh, you'll be there. So, you know, it's going to be fun. Yeah. We're going to do things a little bit differently in terms of timing, which I'm excited about. And just kind of doing stuff to increase that, like, how do we make this about people? Because this is about people.
Yeah, right.
This isn't about Strava. You know what I mean? It's not, there isn't a podium. There aren't finishers. I'll say that this is a ride, not a race. That's a very big distinction for us.
Yeah.
it not only changes insurance massively, which again, yeah, like,
which is nice,
is a huge thing, right? But I think it also gets to what the root of what we're trying to do. This is a ride with 2,000 of your favorite people,
right?
You know, and I think that that community aspect, putting that focus on the people and the experience, like, there's always going to be someone that's going to try to race to finish something first, and I love that. But like, this isn't about the first five people for me. You know, this is about everybody in the middle.
Right. Yeah. Like, if you want to compete with your buddy.
Oh, yeah. You're going to do it anyway.
You've been training and see who's a little bit quicker, this and that. Sure. Totally good, right?
Absolutely.
No big deal. But whoever gets first, quote unquote, probably gets the exact same handshake, hug, and high five as the person who finishes
precisely
DFL, you know.
Yep, that is exactly
handshake, hug, and a high five,
it's like, hey,
you know.
You did a thing. Congrats.
Yep.
And I mean, and genuinely, I mean that.
No,
like,
I agree 100%.
But that's it.
Yep. And dates?
May 16th.
Did you say that? May 16th.
Is the Saturday.
May 16th, Northfield, Minnesota.
You got it.
No registration cost. Just get there.
No registration cost.
Get there. Go ride with my buddy. I'm really, I just shot my wife a message recently, and I was like, yeah, I think we got to go to this one.
I think you should.
And she's like, yeah, I think we should go to that one.
There'll be a lot of good people. The town is doing some cool things too. So, like, the town has been very supportive of it. You know, and I joke, like, I've known the chief of police 20 years, and, like, you know, like, we've been talking for a while. So, there, we'll have limited camping, but free camping both Friday night before the event and Saturday night after.
Sure.
You know, so, they're like, they're making a concerted effort as well to say, you know, we want you to come in town to do the event, but, like, man, maybe don't ride. Like, don't just drive home after you've ridden your bike for 10 hours. Like,
for a while.
Stay and hang out. We got, there's restaurants, there's breweries. You know, we want you to bring your kids. That's something we talk about on the way. Like, we got a great state park that's on route. There's a YMCA in town that's phenomenal. If, like, you know, if it sucks, bring your kids and go swimming. You know, like, there's stuff to do. So we want to make this more about, you know, families as well, or just, you know, kind of this bigger experience as opposed to the traditional put everybody in the van, drive to watch, you know, mom or dad start the bike race,
leave
and then
for
see
10
him.
Hours.
And, right.
Yeah.
You know, it, like, it's one of the biggest things we're excited about in bringing this style of event to Northfield is that there really is a community around it. There's, you know, both St. Olaf and Carleton have public art centers. I mean, there's, like, there's all kinds of rad stuff to do that happen to be built around a bike race or a bike right. ride, as opposed to just this, like I said, something that doesn't have those supporting aspects of it as well.
Yeah, I think you're seeing that in gravel races that are kind of growing in prominence, mm-hmm. is that not only has the community got involved yep. with the race to a degree and support at minimum, but the places have some cool stuff, big, small, north, south, east, west. They've got some cool things. And when you can tie and make those connections
yep.
to places, then you've increased the value of a free ride, you know,
sure.
and all those kind of things, and they keep coming back for more, and they have good pleasurable experiences.
Yeah, it's gonna be cool.
Yeah, man, I'm looking forward to it.
Glad to have
website
you.
Just went up. Check
website
it out.
Went live. The
HeywoodRide.com. HeywoodRide.com. We're gonna do social media in a second.
Yeah, all that stuff.
Yeah, come on, jumping the gun on me, Ben.
Oh, hey.
All right, so I want to try something new with you.
All right.
The lightning round.
Pow, pow, oh boy. Pow. Okay.
One, two, three. Five questions.
Fair.
Top of the head. We already touched on one of them, so it'll be easy. All right. Are you ready?
I'm ready as I'm going to be.
Yeah, I know. Blank hamburger. Patty and bun. What goes on it?
Ooh, mushroom, Swiss, and bacon.
Deal.
Maybe a fried egg.
Oh, I always get down.
I like a fried egg.
Best carbon upgrade. Doesn't matter. Just component.
Handlebars.
Great. Favorite terrain to ride on? We've talked gravel and fat and all this. Favorite terrain? Tough one.
I think I'll always be a mountain biker at heart.
Understood. Best cycling event that you've ever been to?
Boy, that's a big one. I might say it most impactful probably was El Monzo.
Yeah.
In terms of just, you know, eye-opening in terms, like, what can you do with community to bring people together?
Right, totally understand.
That was a big one for me.
Yeah. Favorite whiskey?
I like most decent whiskey.
Most is an acceptable answer.
Maybe an Oban 12-year.
Yeah, totally into that.
Probably is a good, solid one to start with.
Great. Ben has survived the lightning round. You know, that, man, I really appreciate your time. You know, people don't know. Ben let me stay at his house last night, you know. This is my friend, somebody I respect. How do people get in touch with Whiskey Components first and foremost? Sure. The Haywood probably second, and then if you feel like expressing any of your own Instagram, Facebook kind of stuff, feel free, but you don't have to do that. Let's get Whiskey and Haywood out there.
Yeah, I would do that. If you know, Whiskey's on all social media channels. Whiskey Parts Co. is the Facebook handle and also the Instagram handle. So check us out there. It's where we'll have pretty bikes to look at, ways to upgrade your bike. You can just try to build that community there. Email questions, info@whiskeyparts.com. We'll get you to any whiskey related stuff. We also obviously follow messages on Facebook or Instagram as well. The HaywoodRide.com will be the website for the new ride. We're on Facebook and Instagram as The Haywood Ride. So, again, not a hard one to find.
Pretty tricky titles going on.
Yeah.
I want to know about The Haywood Ride. What should I search?
If you Google The Haywood Ride.
I want to find out about Whiskey Parts Company. What should I look up?
We'll try to make it as easy as possible.
I dig it, buddy. I'm AM Blake 50 on Instagram. I'm just Adam Blake on Facebook. I do work at World of Bikes in Iowa City, Iowa. We're World of Bikes IC on Instagram, and just World of Bikes on Facebook. Of course, if you're already listening to this, you know we are on fatbike.com. Number one place, in my opinion, I'll say it every time, it's just my opinion. Number one place for fat bike information, but more than just that now. Gravel information, sure, to an extent, plus bikes, branching out. You know, fatbike.com, your place for a lot of information.
Community.
Community, more of this, what we got going on right here. Ben, buddy, thank you so much. Adam, I really appreciate your time. What a pleasure, man.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.